Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How do you build a billion-dollar brand if you have no marketing experience? You know these boots, right? These are my wife's. She calls them Uggs. She loves wearing them. Brian Smith is the man whose vision created these boots that you know and have seen around the world. He's a former accountant who founded UGG Australia and sold it to Deckers Outdoor. I invited him here to tell the story of how he did it and to teach us how he built this mega brand. Brian recently wrote a book about his experiences in business. And Brian, can you show the book cover? It's a really well-written book called The Birth of a Brand. It's available everywhere. Yeah, let's get it towards the center a little bit more. I want to make sure that people see it. So if they happen to be in a bookstore or see it online, recommend it to them, they recognize it. We'll talk about some of the stories from that book. It's all sponsored by TopTal. If you're having trouble finding the right developer, one who is not just a great developer, but also is a good cultural fit with your company, I want you to check out TopTal. Top as in the top, and Tal as in talent. They are a network of elite, pre-vetted software developers, people who've been proven to be in the top 3% among their peers on a global scale. We're talking about the best of the best developers. So you tell TopTal who you're looking for, they will comb their network for the right people, they will only bring you the one or two people who they think are a good fit for you, they'll make sure they're tested and vetted and perform well for you. You can talk to those developers, and if you want to hire and you pick the one you want to hire, and when you're ready to go, you can hire them on a full-time basis, on a part-time basis. If you have a good team and just need a few hours of extra work, you can hire your developer through TopTal for a few hours a week. TopTal, they guarantee through a trial period that you will have somebody who will build your business, build your product, and do a great job. I want you to check out TopTal.com, TOPTAL.com. Brian, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew. Should be fun.
Brian, of all the celebrities and people who you've seen wearing boots like these with this on the back, your logo, who are some that stand out and that you're proudest of?
Okay, the first time I ever saw a celebrity wearing them was in Rolling Stone magazine. It was Neil Young. Wow. Sitting in a photograph. And then very soon after that was Tom Petty. And I realized that this had a life in the entertainment industry that I had no idea of how they got them. But the pinnacle was many years later, like 17 years later, when Oprah had them on the Best Picks for Christmas for like 25 minutes on national TV. That was the pinnacle.
I read in the Wall Street Journal that turned sales, or actually didn't turn them around. They were growing, but boy, did it jumpstart those sales.
It really did. She has an amazing power, yes.
Interesting that Neil Young, a musician, was the first person who was a big celebrity that you saw wearing them. Music seemed to play a role in the creation of the business. In fact, you were listening to a Pink Floyd album when your life was changed. What was a Pink Floyd album?
It was Dark Side of the Moon, and I was an ex-accountant. I'd quit because I didn't like it. I graduated and then quit the same day. And I didn't know what to do. So one time I just discovered the new Pink, the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon. And I ripped the covering off and I put it on. And the second song said, "Tired of lying in the sunshine, staying home to watch the rain. You are young and life is long and there is time to kill today." And I went, "Oh my God, he's talking to me." And then it went on and said, "But then one day you find 10 years have got behind you. No one told you when to run. You missed the starting gun." And I just got goosebumps and I went, "Oh my God, 10 years I've been trying to graduate as an accountant. I've hated the whole time. And all my friends are tracking along nicely and I'm standing still." So that spurred me to go to America because all the new trends were coming out of California. And I was going to go find the next big trend and bring it back to Australia.
What's a trend that you saw coming from California or the United States and hitting it big in Australia that helped inspire this decision?
Well, lots of diverse things like waterbeds and Levi jeans and, all the surf brands that were coming down were really influential for me because I was a really big surfer at the time. And it just seemed like California was such a creative, place.
Surfer Magazine actually was another reason why UGG was created. What happened with Surfer Magazine? What did you see there?
Well, I'd been in California 3 months and still hadn't found the really big thing. And one day my buddy was coming over, and we came over and we were going to go surf Malibu. And he brought Surfer magazine with him, and I was just flicking through it, and I suddenly stopped at one photo. It was a image of two pairs of legs up in front of a fireplace, and they were wearing sheepskin boots. And I just went, oh, my God, I got goosebumps again. And I've come to think that that's my spirit telling me you're on the right track, you know. But I just went, oh, my God, Doug, there's no sheepskin boots in America. And he said, well, of course, it's so warm here. I said, no, you don't get it. One in two Australians own some sort of sheepskin footwear. We're going to do this, and we're going to make millions.
And so it was the reverse of what you anticipated. You thought you were going to the U.S., to America, and bring back a brand, bring back a product to Australia and make it big there. Now you're thinking, let's take something from Australia and spread it throughout the United States.
It's funny how the universe works, yeah.
You know what? You've said that a couple of times, that you've made references to the universe bringing things to you. It seems that that's one of your beliefs, that when you have an intention, when you have something in mind, the opportunities will coalesce. Am I right?
Always, always, yeah. It's a fascinating thing. It's like, here's a good story. If you're looking for, you know, if you are asked, you know, how many refrigerator advertisements have you seen this week, you would go, none. But the minute you start to need a refrigerator, you will see the damn things everywhere. There's everywhere as an advertisement for a refrigerator. And the point is, all the information is out there in the universe, but until you tune in to one aspect of what you want to do or what you want to buy or what you want to have for your life, only then does the universe sort of kick in and put in front of you everything you need.
Brian, how structured are you about that? Is it the kind of thing that you write down, that you organize, or is it just a pop thought hits your head that says, you know what, it'd be good to find something to bring back to the U.S. and build a big company? Which way is it?
It's really the lines blur. You have to have the intention, number one. You don't have to know the answer, but you have to have the intention. Excuse me. And if you do that, then the information starts to flow your way and it solidifies what direction you are choosing.
But do you write it down? Do you tell other people? Do you do anything else to make the intention more real and to keep it top of mind?
I have done a lot of journaling in the past. I do write lists of priorities every month, and that's what keeps me on track. So every month I get my daily planner and I bring forward all the stuff that hasn't been done. But most of all, I do my priorities, and it's those priorities that sort of bring me back into alignment with what I'm trying to do.
The first reaction to this idea that you had was, I don't get it. Boots? Who wears boots? Who said that?
That was my surfing buddy, Doug. And when we started out, he went on the road with our samples. You know, we bought some samples, he came back after 2 weeks with a manila folder full, probably had 200 or 300 business cards in there of all the retail stores that he'd visited, and not a single order. And he's saying, everybody says it's California. There's no, you know, nobody wears sheepskin in California. And I said, but look, California is exactly the same market as Australia. But we listened, and I found out there was a trade show on in New York. And I thought, oh, well, maybe they're used to colder weather back there. So I bought, you know, three pairs of boots with me and went to a little trade show in New York City. And not one person spoke to me in 3 days. And it was disheartening. I may as well. They were looking at the pumps from Spain on, you know, the Taiwan on one side and the espadrilles from Spain on the other. And I may as well have had meat or car parts there, because nobody even got that I was in the footwear industry. And it was very demoralizing to have no interest in 3 days. But on the plane back to California, I started to think, well, why do my close buddies back there rave about how good these are? And it came to me that they were all surfers. And in California, all the surfers who went to Australia, you know, for their, you know, weekly or monthly surfing trip came back with 4 or 5 pairs of boots. So it was really well known in the surf market.
I see. And so instead of going broad and competing against people who are selling espadrilles or buying pumps, you decided, no, this is our market, surfers. And I'm not a surfer, but I know what you're talking about. I've swam here in the San Francisco Bay. When I come out, My body is cold, but my feet are colder than anything else. And if I could warm my feet up properly and it takes a long time, then I feel good. And is that what it's like for surfers?
Yeah. I mean, the sheepskin wicks moisture, so you can put them on with wet feet, and within 10 minutes, you know, all the moisture's evaporated and your feet are warm. It's just the most amazing product.
We should also talk about how you made these shoes. In fact, you didn't make these shoes. They already existed. A company called, Country Leather.
Yep.
How did you get Country Leather to allow you to sell these shoes in the U.S., to sell these boots?
Well, they were the ones that ran the ad in Surfer Magazine, so I called them up, and the owner had had several requests from California, from all over America, really, wanting to import them. But I think because I was from Western Australia and we had some connections, which was a sort of a fluke in the Australian Trade Commission, where one of my rugby buddies was talking to him, I think that swayed the vote. So we were the ones given the right to import his product.
I read in your book that you just laid thick the whole Australian connection, and he trusted you. But if he was already selling ads, then if he was already, buying ads and selling boots, why did he even need you at all or anyone?
It's a difficult product to mail order from a tiny little town in Australia.
I see.
And I had a bigger vision. You know, I really saw this as a category within the footwear industry that I thought I could build into. And I used to own a pair in Australia, so I just knew the comfort. And I just wanted to get a pair on every single person in America. So that's the reason I set up the business in America and started importing.
So I read in your book that he gave you the go-ahead, and you decided that you would test the market in Southern California. It seems like the test that you ran in California came up failure. The test that you ran at the trade show said no. Why continue? How did you know that this idea still had legs if your test seemed to have failed?
You know, it's there's two answers. One is that I convinced some investors to put $20,000 into this little venture, and I bought 500 pairs of boots. My first year's sales was 28 pairs. That's the time a rational person would have given up. But I had, you know, 490 or 80 pairs left in my spare bedroom, and I owed a duty to my investor to try and get rid of them. So I sort of got stuck into staying in business. But the other part of it is that I knew that one in two Australians seemed to own some sort of sheepskin footwear. So I knew that the product was good. I knew it was viable for America because the climate's the same. I just had no idea that Americans' perception of sheepskin was so different from Australians. You know, Australians know it's rugged. You can get it wet. You can wash it. But Americans, oh, it's too delicate, it's hot, it's sweaty, you can't wear them outside. And so the perception was what I realized I had to change.
I see. So you had a sense of what you needed to do to fix it. Wasn't clear. It wasn't clarity, but it was a sense of it. You also understood that it worked in another market. You also had all those shoes at home. And so you had to find a way to make it work. First year sale, we're talking about 1979. You sold 28 shoes. Do you remember how much revenue that was?
Exactly $1,000. But here's the irony. There's not a billion-dollar company out there today that didn't start with $1,000.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
So it was $1,000. How did you sell them? How did you sell those 28 shoes?
Well, we first went to all the shoe retailers in the surf industry, and they said, oh, my God, you guys are going to make a fortune if you bring those in. I've got a pair. A buddy brought them back from Australia. You know, so that's why we bought the 500 pairs. But when we went back on the road, it was – oh, well, we know you're going to do really well, but we couldn't sell them out of this store because we just sell surfboards and shorts and you know, sandals. But you're going to do great, you know. So that's where we really hit the wall that first year. But I started.
Let me just be clear about that before you continue. I'm sorry to interrupt, but
that's all right.
You are literally getting in the car, driving out to stores that you never knew before, essentially cold calling them by walking in and saying, here's this strange thing that you think is not going to be right, but I want to convince you that it is going to be fine for you. Okay?
Yep.
And so if that didn't work, what were you going to say?
Well, I started filling my van full of all the size runs, and every time I went surfing at Malibu, I would open up the back of the van, and I'd be open for business. And every person that bought them raved about them so much that I got one or two people come back. So the word of mouth business was really, really strong. And I also started doing the swap meets in California. And, you know, on an average weekend, we could sell 20, 30, 40 pairs a weekend. So that's how I started to dwindle down all the inventory that I had.
Let's talk a little bit about brand. The name, yeah. UGG, it was short for ugly, right?
Nobody knows. Everybody's got a different version on where that name came from. It was a sort of a generic name in Australia as UGG. And I just, you know, registered the trademark in America because nobody else had done it here. And, you know, legally I could do that. And so, yeah, it's a question I get all the time, but I really don't have a definitive
answer.
So
how did you come up with that? So it wasn't ugly. I just be clear. That's what I read online. But you're saying that's not necessarily it. Nobody knows where it comes from. It was just a phrase. In fact, nobody knew how it was spelled. I've seen it spelled UG, UGG, yeah. UGH, you spell the company name
everything
UGG.
You can think of, yeah. Yeah, so, I just chose UGG because it was very simple and clean.
That's what it was. Why not come up with something that was less, something that wasn't in the dictionary, something that was more unique? Because for me, the name is what I associate with all those shoes that I've seen. The name is such, it might even be a bigger part of, here, look, if I look at the shoe, this boot, this right here is more important, I think, to me and my wife than the rest of it.
Without a doubt.
Right? Why did you come up with that? Why did you go with the name that had already been in the dictionary?
Number one, I knew that it was a really good name. From a marketing viewpoint, there's two ways to look at it. If you were a young kid and you developed the swoosh mark in California and you spent $1,000 and then you got out of business, nobody would know what that swoosh mark was. It's the billions of dollars that Nike put into it that really established the brand. I always thought UGG was a sort of a word that we could sort of stylize it with a really good logo, that it was simple, clean, it's very memorable. It's unlike anything else. It's not descriptive of a feeling or anything. It's just a word. And I thought that would be the strongest brand. And it wasn't until many, many years, you know, later that we spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of impressions that it finally took on its own life. And that's the same with any brand that you put into the marketplace.
I see. Did you test it in any way? Talk to surfers, see that they're referring to it later on after you've used the word?
No, they all knew of UGG in some way before I even started, and that's really why I did it. It already had a recognition in the surf market.
I see. Okay. All right. So now you've got this brand. You start to get shoes. The first shoes I read had ugly brown smears on them, issues. Talk to me about that.
Quality control was horrible. I mean, in Australia, it hadn't even become a real business yet. It was just a craft industry with lots of little sheepskin factories, you know, turning out all different types of products. I did a lot of work with the manufacturer to clean up the soling, the gluing, the stitching, the overall look of it. But what really sort of kicked it into the big market was, I always had a problem with how do people didn't know how to wear them, right? So I started advertising with these really cool models on the rocks at Wind and Sea Beach and had perfect hair and perfect boots and perfect sunset and everything. And, you know, the sales for that second year were $30,000. So the following year I got more expensive models and better photographers and perfect boots and again, $30,000. And I couldn't understand why I wasn't sort of reaching the market. And I was trying to get into the malls. And it wasn't until I got to Montgomery Wards in Chicago where the buyer said, "Brian, why are you here?" And I said, "Because I want to get an order for the California stores." And he said, "Don't you get it? We're the elephants. We don't move till the mice are running around under our feet." And I instantly knew that what he meant was if I could get all the specialty stores, you know, in a frenzy, then they would come on. So when I got back to California, I had a beer with one of my buddies who owned a surf shop, and he just sort of leaned back in his chair and called in the young grommets from the back.
Said, "Hey, this is Rob Ard."
Yeah, yeah. "What do you guys think of Uggs?" And just to a man, they all just went, oh, those Uggs, they're so fake, man. Have you seen those models? They can't surf. And instantly I knew I'd been sending the wrong image to my target market, because these were the kids that I was trying to get to. So I, the next day, within a week, I'd signed on a couple of young pro surfers and started running ads with them in the next month or two. And the sales jumped from 30,000 to nearly 400,000 like in one season, purely because I hit the right image. And that to me was when I, the first day, I understood what true marketing was about. I had to get everybody who's reading the ad to want to be in that ad so badly that they were going to buy whatever it took to get there.
And by being in the ad, you don't mean literally being hired by you as the next spokesperson for the shoe. You meant they want to be like the person who's in the ad.
Absolutely.
And, your customers did not want to be models. They wanted to be surfers.
Exactly. They wanted to be hardcore, and they wanted to be in those ads. They wanted to be walking that same sort of path to Trestles or Black's Beach that Mike Parsons was, you know?
So when I look at your past and think, boy, this guy's going store to store to store, that's drudgery. Yeah, it's tough, but you wouldn't have been able to have a conversation like the one that you had where the salespeople told you these shoes are fake because the ads are fake. You wouldn't have had that conversation and that understanding unless you went through each store.
That's right. Yeah, you got to pay the dues, you know.
What about your co-founder? I thought it was Doug Jensen who's supposed to be the salesperson, and you as the former accountant who's supposed to be in the office accounting for things. How did you end up out there? I hated sales. You did sales too.
I was terrified. I was terrified of sales. But when we split up and he went up into the San Fernando Valley and started selling, and my territory was the coast, like I'd stayed home for 3 days, and finally the guilt got to me that Doug's on the road and I'm not. And that forced me to go and make my very first cold call. And it wasn't until like the third or fourth store where they go, oh man, they're great, those sheepskin boots. Then I started to get some confidence. But yeah, it was a stretch for an accountant like me to become a salesman.
Did you ever come up with a formula for getting a sale or for starting a conversation with a store owner? What was it?
The first thing is I wanted to establish just the connection, regardless of the product I had in my bag. I just wanted to establish a connection. Hey, how you doing? How's the store doing? You know, tell me a little bit about it so I could understand what their issues were. And then I could bring out my product. Obviously, at first, they'll go, oh, sheepskin boots in a surf shop? Get out of here, you know? And I got that a lot. But eventually, just by being, you know, coming back, I got to be friends. And that friendship led into he's trying so hard, let's give him a try in the store, you know?
So that's what it was.
It was. It was purely on a human basis. And I think that's what all sales is. If you can humanize it to the most, you know, the biggest extent possible, that's when you're going to have your most success.
So if we're looking at your growth, your ability to sell as a company, it started out with driving to surf shops, swap meets. Yep. That was in the early days. Then you moved on to buying ads. The ads were beautiful people, beautiful people. And then it moved on to ads with real surfers, and that's what helped the brand really take off.
Credibility, yeah.
Was it more expensive to get how much more expensive was it to get real surfers to pose for the ads?
Oh, it was cheaper than the models.
Interesting.
Yeah, I just gave them a couple of pairs, well, as many boots as they wanted, plus a couple of $100, you know. And they were fresh coming into being a pro anyway, and it was actually saved me money.
Here's another one that I see, that one of the reasons why you got into it was, well, here, Action Sports Retailer, volume number one. How did that factor into your growth?
That was pure luck. That's the universe sort of dropping in my lap what I needed. I was in the lawyer's office, you know, finalizing the details for our investor, and the very first volume one was on the desk of the receptionist. And I looked at it and I said, do you mind if I scan this? And it's a magazine targeted towards the surf shops and the action sports shops. And I went, oh my God, that's who I'm trying to target. And so had I not figured out who my target was, or if I hadn't bought any boots in and I was in that same lawyer's office, I never would have looked at that magazine. It would have been there. I wouldn't have seen it. So that's an example of the universe just putting in front of you, or you becoming aware of information that's in the universe that can help you.
You know, for you to care that much, you have to be hungry, don't you? Because you could have given up for so many reasons. Yeah, you had those shoes, but you could have sold them on the cheap and moved on. I keep calling them shoes. I should call them boots. Yeah, for me, any footwear is the word shoe, which is not technically correct.
No, that's fine, yeah.
Where does the hunger come from for you? What is it that drove you?
Well, I was driven by the fact that one in two Australians had some sort of sheepskin footwear. And I knew, because I'd worn them so long, that it was a brilliant product. So I just, that was really what drove me.
Lots of brilliant products that I don't end up buying the companies for. I love race-ready shorts because for long-distance running, I could put my gels, I could put my phone in the pockets and not feel weighed down. I'm not going to buy the company or sell or work hard for it. There's something about the drive. Is it going back to that song, Time, that you said, I need to leave my mark on this world? Or was it just the momentum of having started and the rational belief that, of course, everyone in the U.S. should wear this, or at least one in two the way they are in Australia?
Well, there's a rule that I've come up with, which is every good entrepreneur has to have a certain amount of ignorance or even innocence, right? Because in my mind, this was already a million-dollar business. Not a billion, but it was a millions and millions of dollars business. I just didn't know how to get it there at the time. So that was the passion that drove me. I want to improve the planet, but that wasn't the UGG story.
What about, you're a fan of Napoleon Hill. One of the things Napoleon Hill says is, be aware of your goals. In fact, he says, write them down so that the universe can start to bring the resources that you need in order to get them.
The
other thing he says is, be aware of why you want it. What is it about the goal? What is the motivation? Did you have something like that, a big why?
The why was I wanted to be in my own business because I spent those 10 years as an accountant. So now the next question is, what business? Well, sheepskin boots has such incredible potential. This is going to be my goal. And you can imagine why I didn't give up being an accountant for 10 years, because I had to graduate first. That same thing took over in the UGG business, which is, I am not giving up on this because I see the potential and I'm going to make it work.
What a statement. And one of the things that you did to make it work in the early days, if stores would call you up and ask you for one pair or two pairs, you would fulfill that order, where I would think you'd say, you know what? Let me send you a dozen or nothing. I can't work this hard just to send you one pair. I'm not in the mail order business. I'm in the wholesale business.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
That's a really key point, Andrew. I had a very long-term view of this. And in my book, I talk about every business goes through a cycle. My theme is, you can't give birth to adults. Right? Every business has a conception and then some action is taken which gives it birth. And that was me buying samples from Australia. That was a birth. Then you go into this horrible infancy where it, like every little infant, just lies in the cradle, just wants to be, you know, loved. It gets fed, it gets diapers changed. And there's no amount of urging can get that infant to get up out of the cradle and go to college. It has to be an infant. But eventually it'll toddle and then get into the youth and the teenage phase and maturity. Well, I was in this infancy period with the UGG boots, and I just knew that it was a long-term process, just like having a baby is. You know, it's not going to get old overnight. And so I figured, okay, how can I service my retailers with the least amount of pain for them and the best long-term benefit? And I knew if I loaded them up with 50 pairs of boots and they had 45 left on hand at the end of the season, they were going to hate me and hate UGG boots, right? So I went into this deliberate customer service routine where even if they wanted one or two pairs to fill in, like I need a pair of sevens, I need two pairs of nines, that's what I shipped them. And I never oversold them. And I went even as far as during the season, like this is like 5-10 years later, where they all had 50-60 pairs of inventory in their stores. I would go into the stores, at least weekly, sometimes monthly if they were smaller, and I would do all the inventory for them, and I'd take back sizes that weren't selling, and I would fill in sizes that were, all with the goal of leaving them empty at the end of the season. And guess what happened? Come the trade show next year, they're all going, shit, we sold through all of those. Let's buy some more. And that was really that customer service, I got to say, is the biggest factor in the early years of the survival of the business.
I'm seeing on my screen here a later version, a Jimmy Choo UGG boots, which has all kinds of design on it. That is not the kind of design that you had when you ran the company. It was consistent year after year, similar. Was it even the same year after year?
Yeah, very similar. Our product development was slow, but it was deliberate, because we would introduce product at the trade shows, which are usually in January, February, March, right? Because then we'd have to deliver September, October, November. And I was always out there first with the new colors and the new styles and the new trims. Everybody else would see them at that first show in March. So by the time we shipped that season, we were the only ones shipping. But the next season, all the stuff that we'd done was copied, and it was on every other competitor's thing. But I had already come up with new styles and new colors and new trims. So my mantra for the business was, don't obsess about the competitors. Just get out first and then run faster.
How would you come up with the designs? If we're talking about apparel, if we're talking about shoes, design is critical. How does an accountant come up with the right design that everyone's going to want?
Very slowly. The evolution was sort of small, in small steps for the first 5 to 10 years. But then we were very successful in California, but we had a lot of resistance in the ski areas and back east, like Minneapolis through New York, where we have mud, we have slush, we don't use those little soles. You know, we need real boots. So that was a big step in product development, where I had to get rubberized soles that cupped up so that the puddles, you know, you could walk through water and puddles, where it didn't actually get into the leather itself. So that was the beginning of our product development. I mean, we changed colors and we changed trims and stuff like that, which were very easy. But the real development came trying to get into the cold weather market.
What about the colors and trims? Who does that? Did you hire someone to do it?
No, not at first. We used to have braids up the back. So I would get in touch with the braid company and look at their selections, and I would select, you know, two or three braids from 50. And the colors of the skins, you know, I would get swatches from the tannery to see what colors they could do. And then I would select different colors that I thought would be, you know, applicable. So it was pretty basic at first. Nowadays, though, the product development is so sophisticated. You know, since I've sold the company to Deckers, who are really in the footwear industry, they have a very sophisticated product development thing now that goes out with they have a staff of designers that create from beginning.
So, Brian, is it fair to say that when you ran the company, design wasn't paramount? It was the authenticity, it was about the comfort, it was about the utility, with design being secondary for the brand.
I'd say that's a good statement, yeah. Casual comfort was what I was after, and the look had its own sort of unique thing. Lots of people hated it. I mean, that's where the ugly comes from. Lots of people hated them, but those people who wore them just fell in love with them, and they didn't give a damn what people said to them about how ugly they were.
They almost were proud of it. From what I remember, when I first heard about them, there was a pride. It's, of course, I'm not here for design. I'm not here to look great. I'm here to be comfortable. And of course, they know that they look good in it, that there's
There's a counterculture look that
So that's one thing that I've learned from your brand. I always assume that brand always has to be the most designed, the most polished, the best looking out there. No, it has to be aware of what it is.
It's the image that you put around the brand, and that comes back to marketing.
That's what it is. All right, and the name, I understand why you came up with the name now. You at one point considered calling it, am I pronouncing this right, Jackaroos?
Yes, that was a funny period. We had a competitor in the market that called their product UGHS, and they sued us, claiming that they owned the trademark. And anyway, we I was going to at one time. I was thinking that it'd be easier to change the name than it would be to fight this lawsuit. Yep. And so it was a long discussion with me and all my other partners. And the point came where I said, okay, let's not go to court. Let's change it to Jackaroos. But I had the son of one of my friends was riding for what we called the UGG surf team. And I told him one day, hey, we're going to change the name to Jackaroos. And he goes, oh, no, that's a dumb name. We're not going to ride for Jackaroos. We want to ride on the UGG team. And that was the day that I realized the power of 6 or 7 years of marketing and product development and imaging, you know, all of that really paid off with a brand loyalty. And so that was when I decided to fight the lawsuit and stick with the brand.
Yeah, it's really hard to change a name after people gotten used to it. Frankly, I want to change the name Mixergy. What is a Mixergy? Nobody knows.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I have to own Mixer, M-I-X-E-R, and the letter G.com. Yeah. And Mixergy, M-I-X-E-R-G-Y.com. Yeah, and all those variations because nobody knows what it is. But you kind of, once you go with it, it's hard to change. People get used to it. People start to form a connection to it.
They will. And ultimately, it doesn't matter what the name looks like or means. If you've got enough impressions out there from your advertising and enough followers, they're going to follow it just because it's Mixergy. And it's a really good name. I love the name.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Retailers, you wanted them to be aware of this because they were the front lines. They were the people who were talking to customers about it. One of the things you noticed was if a salesperson wore UGG, he understood what it was about, or she was able to communicate to the customer why they should care and why it wasn't going to warm up their feet too much. How did you deal with that? Because most salespeople at stores didn't wear your boots.
Nobody did. I got to say, you know, being modest or immodest, that was one of the most brilliant marketing things I ever did. I knew that if somebody walked into the store and said, what are these UGG boots like? And the store manager or nobody there knew, they were not going to get a sale. So I came up with a plan that, okay, if you buy 6 pairs into your store, I will give you a free pair of your own size to wear while you're working. And the sales went through the roof. It was because the managers of the stores, when somebody asked, what are these UGGs like? The first thing he said, oh, my God, they are the most comfortable thing. You should try them on. And when that happened, bam, instant sale.
It was interesting.
It was a very, very, it was so simple, but probably one of the best marketing tricks I ever did.
You know what? I'm so surprised that microphone makers don't say to themselves, you know what? Let's, and I don't want them to give me this, but let's give all the top podcasters who do video, in fact, even if they don't do video, our microphones, because they're the ones who everyone's listening to. They're the ones who others are looking to for advice.
Yep.
But most people aren't aware of that. What did you call it? I forget. It was the
6-pair stocking plan?
Yeah, basic.
Really basic.
Here's another one that I love from your store, and I don't know the name of this one. Displays. Mm-hmm. You came up with an idea that I think you saw it in a supermarket, if I remember right.
No, it was when I realized that every square foot of flat space in a store has a value, like a dollar value, mm-hmm. and the store has to get a return of, let's say it's $20 per square foot from the store. The UGG product took up a lot of space on the top of a flat shelf. And, you know, the boots were so soft they'd fall over and they'd get displaced. And it was a real nightmare keeping the inventory looking good. So I had to figure out, how do I display these without taking up any shelf space? And the other thing was, nobody really knows how to wear them, so I need models or, you know, these surfers showing, you know, just everyday scenes on how they're worn. And so I came up with this idea to make a flat, you know, wooden display piece, which I hung from the ceiling. And then I had all these plastic chains and plastic clips, like clothes pegs, where I would actually put the product hanging from all these chains. So it was easy to store them on top of the shelves, taking up no floor space, no shelf space, and a great image. And that was another really good breakthrough for retailing. But merchandising is a whole, oh my God, it's a whole industry unto itself. And I just scratched the surface of good merchandising, but that was one of my cleverer attempts.
I could see it. So if it is such a whole industry onto its own, full of experts who do this nonstop, who you're frankly competing with because you're competing for the same square footage in a store, where do you come up with an idea like this, and how do you know that it's going to work before you start investing in it?
That one came from the universe. There was nothing I ever saw like it, but I knew the problems. I knew space, you know, image, and that sort of result just came from thinking.
So here's the thing, though. You're now making your retailer so happy. You're giving their salespeople shoes to wear. Excuse me. Why do I keep calling shoes?
It doesn't matter. They are. I have so many shoes in the range now, you're quite okay.
Right. All right. So you're giving them shoes. You're showing them how to display it and giving them the displays and so on. And still, when it comes time for them to pay you, they think, well, we need the surfboards for next season. Let's pay the guy who sent us surfboards. We need this for next season. Let's pay that guy. Do we really need these boots? Do we really need this footwear? Nah, let's wait before we pay Brian. Right?
That happened a lot, especially in seasons where it didn't get very cold or there was very light snow. That happened to us a lot, and it really crippled my ability to grow the business.
Is that one of the reasons why you sold?
Ultimately, yes. There were two reasons why I sold. One is that I love starting new businesses. I don't really love being in big companies because I think outside the box. You know, I love trying new things, very high-risk things, while companies are very risk-averse. And I knew I was getting stifled. When the company got up to $10, $12 million in sales, I was called into committee meetings and everyone would sort of talk it around and around and around, and then they'd come to a decision which was a sort of a mellowed down mix of everybody's mediocre ideas. So there was nobody willing to take a risk. And that's when I realized I got to get out of here and start something new. The other part of it, though, was financial. We grew so much. The cash flow was such a critical issue because we were seasonal that I needed to get out and find a really, really big investor to be able to handle the seasonality.
You started to look for investors. What happened?
Oh, that was the saddest part of the business was every year I was growing, like doubling. It wasn't a big deal at, you know, $500,000 to $1 million, then $1 million to $2 million. But as it got to $2 million to $4 million and $4 million to $8 million, I needed the cash flow to come from investors from outside because we couldn't grow from our retained earnings. And especially being seasonal, we needed to, you know, cover a whole down cycle of 6 months. But the problem was when I did business plans and went to the banks, it was, oh, these are a fad, man. Yeah, you're lucky this year, but they won't be around next year. And that happened for probably 10, 12 years in a row. And even when it got up to 8 million to 10 million, it was still, oh, yeah, you got lucky last year, but it's a fad. It'll never be around. And, you know, I sold the business with that mentality in the banks and the investment bankers and the venture capitalists.
Fair to say that that wasn't something you were especially strong at, because Doug Otto, founder of Decker, who you sold your business to,
yep,
he was able to raise money. He even took his company public. It feels like he has some special skill for it or talent for it.
But he did. He was much more analytical than I was, where I was more of a marketing, advertising, you know, customer service type. He was a lot more analytical, but he had the same problems. He had tried to buy me, like, you recall in the book how he and I were selling our products out of the back of the vans at Malibu Beach, right?
Mm-hmm.
He suffered tremendously until he took on a line called Teva, you know, the Teva sandals.
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, I talk about societal shifts. I don't know if you remember that, mm-hmm, but, you know, well, you know, there was one point where there was a little running shoe company making running shoes in Oregon, and it wasn't until the sport of jogging took off that this running shoe company had to get sucked along with it and sold hundreds of millions. That was called Nike.
Mm-hmm.
then another societal shift happened in Southern California. There was a little company selling these little white kid leather shoes to dance classes and jazzercise and cheerleading teams. And it was really good soft dancing shoe. But then the sport of aerobics took off nationwide, and that little tiny company got sucked along, hundreds of millions of dollars. That was Reebok. Well, Teva got sucked into the outdoor market when the outdoor market took off, and that was how they were able to go public.
I see.
And by a fluke of really bad mistakes inside my company when I had new investors, we missed that sort of that boom. And so we got left behind, and so Doug had always tried to buy us a couple of times. And I used to joke with him, Doug, you know, you can't afford us. But ultimately, he was the one that took his company public on that boom. But he still had the seasonal problem
because he was selling Teva, and he needed opposite season, and that's
always
where you came in.
He used to die every winter. We used to die every summer. Yeah.
Yeah, and meanwhile, you were putting it all on your credit cards. I think you mortgaged your house in order to run this business.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about what you did for branding. One of the things that you did was you hired a PR company, and you said that's one of the best decisions that you made. Why?
That was funny. But by now, we were doing like $8 to $10 million, so I could afford to hire outside help. And I knew that I wanted to get into the casual comfort sort of imaging, and surfing was a great niche, but it was just California. Skiing and snowboarding was a great niche, but it wasn't mainstream. Ice hockey rinks, you know, was great in the Midwest up to the Northeast, but that was a very localized market. I wanted to get into the mainstream, and so I figured if I could get in a national newspaper like USA Today, then that would be a national statement that now we're in the casual comfort business. So we set up a PR firm that took me on tours through, you know, Boston, New York, Philadelphia. You know, but the pinnacle for me was Chicago at USA Today. And we walked in. We had an appointment with Margaret, who is the fashion editor. And when we got there at 5 to 3 in the afternoon, she came out and goes, "Oh, my God, Brian, I'm so sorry. I've double booked, and I have to be on a conference call at 3. I've got 5 minutes. Well, I mean, I had the perfect pitch deck. I had the brochures. I had the press releases. I had everything ready. And I went, "Oh, my God, I'm not going to have a chance to show that." So I reached into my file, you know, my briefcase, and I just had a file full of photos of celebrities, of, you know, Neil Young, Tom Petty, Sting, Patrick Swayze, you know, all these celebrities. And then there was one of Pamela Sue Anderson on the Baywatch show wearing white, tall white Ugg boots in a red swimsuit. And I quickly flicked past that because I didn't want to show her that. And she caught it and she goes, "Go back. What was that?" And so before I knew it, she'd photocopied that tabloid thing from a London newspaper and written down the name of the photographer. And she said, "Brian, do you have a press kit? Good. I've got to go." So that was less than 3 or 4 minutes, right? And I just went, "Oh, my God, this whole public relations tour was for nothing because, you know, we got all this little regional stuff, but we missed the big one." Well, the next day I was flying back to San Diego from Chicago, and I did my routine of buying coffee in the USA Today, and I flicked through to the lifestyle section, and, oh, my God, there in the front middle, full page, you know, well, not a full page, but a main ad, photograph of Pamela Sue Anderson, and the best story about Uggs as a category, as an industry, as the history, the future. And she must have stayed up all night researching that because it was just a hit. By the time I got back to California, I found out that the phones had been going all day from retailers, you know, wanting to buy the product, and all day from consumers wanting to know where they could buy them. So it was one of those flukes that really made me realize PR can be a really good thing.
What was the reason why you – what was the news part of you going out and talking to the media? What was the story?
The story was new casual comfort.
That's what it was.
Casual comfort, yet still rugged enough to wear where you are. Yeah,
I see. And for the fashion world and for the apparel world, that's enough of a story.
That's what I needed to get across. Yeah,
I see. All right, so that's one of the things that you did. The other thing that you did concurrently that I didn't understand until I read your book. In fact, the Wall Street Journal, I read about this in the Wall Street Journal. They didn't understand it. Now I get it. Rush Limbaugh. I wouldn't think of all those celebrities and Rush Limbaugh being in the same world. How did you end up with Rush Limbaugh as a spokesperson or doing spots on his show?
Well, there's a great story in my book. Can I show the cover again?
Yeah.
There it is.
There it is. The story really is fantastic. You're really open about what happened, including that private meeting you had with him.
It's full of all. It's everything we've talked about is in the book. It's full of stories of overcoming these things. I can tell you, because it's now in the book, I fought that initiative to use Rush Limbaugh. My investor was like a Rush Limbaugh fan, and Rush was really being just done Snapple, and he had a huge reach back then in the Clinton era, and it was him against Clinton, you know. And I knew that that was going to polarize our audience, and Rush is not a casual comfort person. He's a starched shirt, tie, you know.
Today he wears golf shirts. Back then he refused to be seen on camera without a tie.
He was very stuck in his own image, and it was not the image that I was trying to promote for casual comfort. And the interesting thing is that, yes, he was incredible in bringing customers to us, but in my mind, they were not the right customers. We had a casual comfort market building, and suddenly it all went to Rush Limbaugh's. But I'll tell you, the very first day it came on the radio, he said, "Hey, folks, you know, tomorrow we have a new sponsor. It's called Uggs, and they're sheepskin boots out of California." And I swear within 60 seconds, our phone bank, we had like 20 lines into the company. They all just lit up red, and they didn't go away till Christmas. And so all of our customers who were trying to call in with reorders couldn't get through. And all these new people coming on board, you know, hey, Rush told us we got to buy Uggs. Where can we go to get them, you know? And the number of stockbrokers that were calling, hey, is Ugg public? Can we buy stock? You're going to go public soon? And consequently, yeah, we sold out that year, but we would have sold out without Rush, in my opinion. And it's just one of those fluky things where we, you know, the good news is, it didn't damage us. The following year, everybody still loved Uggs. They still wanted to come back and buy
it. It didn't become a Republican brand. It still was what it was.
It still was just a
Why not get more phone lines then if you were still going regular customers?
We put in twice as many phone lines. But then we put answering machines on every line, and then it was like every night there was 50 messages to answer from 50 lines. That was 2,500 messages a day.
You know, Brian, I can't believe he had that kind of a reach. Now, I know that, I mean, I can't believe he had that kind of power to sell. I know that people loved him. I used to listen to him in high school. I loved him. I went to watch him do his television show, right. So I get it. But you never know what's puffery and what's not.
He wasn't selling us. He was selling, brokers were calling us. Truckers were calling us.
Truckers, because truckers used to listen to Rush Limbaugh and they'd want to wear what he was saying.
That wasn't adding to our bottom line. It was just like a huge amount of activity that really didn't do anything for us extra than what we could have done.
Because once the ad stopped, they didn't continue to buy.
Yeah. Now, this is nothing against Rush personally. It's strictly a marketing issue that I think if we spent the same amount of money we'd spent on Rush in Elle magazine and Glamour magazine and Us magazine, we could have established a much, much bigger image that would have long-term benefited. In fact, that's what Deckers did after they bought the business. They had the money to advertise in those venues. That's how come it's become a billion-dollar company from a $20 million company, which was when I had it.
Here's what you say in the book. Total cost of 1 minute spots 5 times a week for 3 months, nearly $500,000 for radio. This is more than the cost of running full page ads in Glamour and Elle magazines for an entire season.
Yep.
That's what it was. But you know what? You got to tell the story of the little old lady who became one of your customers because of Rush Limbaugh. What happened?
That's how ridiculous the Rush campaign was. But again, it shows how it generated sales, you know? This little grandmother, I heard this from the owner of Spider Surf Shop, which is like the most hardcore, you know, skull and crossbones skate type story in Hermosa Beach, called me up and says, yeah, this grandmother came in. She bought 6 pairs for her family. She'd never seen them before, but she saw the UGG sign out front and said, oh, Rush told me I have to buy these things, you know. So that's how blind his followers can be.
How do I get followers that blind? I would like to have that kind of power where I say to my audience, hey, you know what? Go check this out. And they all flood the stores.
Well, I guess you got to get as controversial and polarizing as Rush.
That's an important point. I mean, honestly, right? If you're going to build a brand as a speaker, it has to be polarizing, it seems like.
It's sad because, you know, people love sensationalism.
Brian, who should I hate?
They love to hate you as much as they love to love you. And that I don't have an answer for you. I love the stories that you and I are talking about now because there's a message and it has a great reach to people who are looking for information. Again, the people in the universe who are looking for what we're talking about are listening to us right now.
They are. I would still like people to be able to go into stores just because I tell them what shoes to wear. That would be awesome. Can you imagine that?
Well, maybe you're doing it right now. Who knows?
What did you sell for? How much?
Many, many millions of dollars.
More. How much of the business did you own at the time of the sale?
I owned about 25% of the business.
And the investor owned how much?
Between them all, they owned the other 75%.
And your partner?
Doug, you're talking about Doug who started?
Doug Jensen.
He only lasted that first year because when we realized that we were going to have to get jobs through the summer, he sort of said, Brian, you know, it's been a good adventure, but I got to go get a real job. And so he quit being a partner and he went off into the movie business, being in LA. He went into the video business. So it was just myself and my investors.
Boy, I thought I had a number here. I usually get at least an estimate of what the business sold for. I can't believe, why can I not get
I never put it in my book. And
here's what I got. Acquired UGG for an estimated $14.6 million.
That was the newspaper report, yeah.
Is it understated?
Yeah, there was royalties on top of that. So,
I see.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for someone who's listening to us who says, listen, I like his story. I'm glad that Brian did well, but I don't want Brian to do well. I want to do well. So if they can... What advice would you pass on to them about how to build a brand that allows them to sell for at least $14 million? I'd like it to be more, but at least that.
Okay. Harken back to my advice that you can't give birth to adults, right? You got to get it through that toddling stage, build it through the infancy, and then build it through the toddling and then youth. If it's a really good product that you have, the only way to get there is through perseverance. And I've got these 4 statements that I've written in the front of my daily, it's on a card and I put it in front of my daily planner. I transfer it every single year. I've done it for 25, 30 years. And it's these 4 simple statements, right? And it's in the book, so you don't have to write them down right now. Feast upon uncertainty, fatten upon disappointment, enthuse over apparent defeat, and invigorate in the presence of difficulties, right? And I found them from a philosophical book 30 years ago, and those 4 principles have been my mainstay when I've been on the point of losing the business, when I've been on the point of giving up, when I found my manufacturer had abandoned me and gone with a competitor, and I didn't have supply. When I found out I'd lost the business by bringing in new investors and they said, Brian, you don't own the business, you're just a sales rep. I mean, disaster after disaster after disaster happened in the course of the 17 years that I ran the business. But those 4 principles, feast upon the uncertainty. Now I look back and I think, you know, the most disappointments that I had were actually my greatest blessings.
Because, what do you mean? Give me an example of one that was a disappointment that it turned out to be a blessing.
Well, one of those instances, I brought 3 new partners into the business because I'd outgrown my old investors. And I didn't get my 25% stake. We were all going to be equal quarters. But I didn't get mine until I finished off that UGHS lawsuit, right? But I became a sales rep, you know, for the California territory. So I went on the road and we moved the warehouse up to Anaheim, which I didn't have to run anymore. So I'm on the road. The very first call I made was to Huntington Surf and Sport. And he says, hey, Brian, I heard you sold the business. And I went, what? He said, yeah, I heard you don't own it anymore. I called an order in. They, you know, the new owner told me you don't own it. And I went, you've got to be kidding me. And I couldn't wait to get out to get to the Shell gas station next door, because this is before cell phones, you know. And I called up from the gas station, said, Neil, what are you telling people? He says, well, it's true, you don't own the business. And I was just crushed, because I thought these were my three new partners. And in their minds, they owned the business and I didn't. And I didn't even work anymore that day. I went back to San Diego and I pulled out the contract and I read it and I'm going, oh, my God. Strictly, I'm not an owner until I do the lawsuit. And so I went through the worst 3 days of my life, because I had visions of building this giant corporation and being the CEO of this humongous corporation where everybody on the planet wore UGG boots, and now I didn't even own it. And so it got so bad that one night I was like lying on the floor after watching TV with my wife, and we turned the TV off, and I rolled over onto all fours. You know, I started crawling to the bedroom, and she said, you don't you dare crawl to the bedroom. Get up now and walk like a man. And I did, and just the act of doing that and her shocking me so much was like, okay, shrug it off. What is the situation right now? I can either be a – what do I want to do? Do I be a business broker? Do I get another job? And I thought, I've come to love sales, believe it or not. I'm an accountant. I come to love sales. And all my friends are on the road. And so I decided, okay, I'm gonna go into sales. What's the best product I could possibly sell? And it came to me, UGG, why not? So I abandoned all my thoughts of ownership and just sucked it up and went back into being a salesman. Well, a month later, I get back into the warehouse and Neil hands me an envelope and I open it up. It's a check for $5,000. And he says, that's your commissions for the month. That was the first money I'd ever pulled out of the business, right? And the next month, there's a check for $10,000. And the next month, another check for $10,000. And I started to realize that I'm on the road. I'm working with all my friends. I'm having a blast. There's no hours of the day. I can work whenever I want. I'm not doing any receiving, any shipping, any invoicing, any accounting. I'm not doing any of the office stuff. And I thought, my God, this is a pretty damn good situation to be in. And that's an example of how my most crushing disappointment turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. And a couple of years later, I owned the business 100% again through a fluke. So
what's the fluke that lets you own the business 100%?
Well, the three guys that had bought me out, you know, they got into a dispute because two of them couldn't come up with the money to bankroll it. So one of them bought the others out, right? And then I got to be really good friends with him because I used to come in and work the business all the time with him. And then he died in a motorcycle accident. But we'd taken out life insurance policies for the business beforehand. And, you know, I'm not going to bore you with how hard it was trying to keep the company afloat for that season while I was trying to figure out where the company was after his death. But the insurance policy allowed me to buy the business back from his wife, you know, his widow. And so who could have predicted that? You know, the universe just has a – because I didn't give up, you know, I could have walked away that day when he died and said, oh, shit, the business, I've lost it, you know. But no, something made me fight. And realize this is something I want to get this out to be everyone in the world has a pair of UGG boots. And that was the universe just keeps coming on, and that's all through my book, because I've got so many examples of things that are not coincidence. They're just literally, had I not been working in that direction, I never would have seen that coming.
That's one of the things that I love about your book. It's full of great stories. It's not just how-to. It's stories like that that illustrate what you've learned along the way.
Yeah, I did not want to be a 12 ways to better profitability or 5 ways to be a better leader. That is the last thing I wanted. This is a real hero's journey. It's a guy who comes from Australia, borrows $500 to buy samples, and sells out for millions. That's the hero's journey that I wanted the book to be, but it's just totally laced with all my philosophy and business lessons, you know?
Yeah, and it's you just watch the business rise. I'm looking here at sales stats that are from the book. You talk about 79, you're at $1,000. 1980, $3,000. 1981, $35,000 a year in sales. 82, yep. 40, and so on. And then it goes to 200, 500. And we're just watching you figure it out and progress along the way. It's so helpful to have you here share those stories and what you've done. What I'm listening to here, when if I can wrap up the brand lessons that I got from this conversation, okay. Tell me if I'm missing anything. It's look for people who hate your product. You walked in and you heard people say, I don't love this thing. It feels like it's fake. And you listened to them and you understood the reason they thought it was fake is because they were all models. Boom. Yep. You replace the models with real surfers, reduce your costs, increase your credibility, and suddenly your sales go up. Second, the name, look for a name that's not like Mixergy, though thankfully if you have a name like Mixergy, better stick with it, but look for a name that actually has some connection to it. Maybe don't spend money on Rush Limbaugh if you don't have enough to spend on Rush Limbaugh. You should be aware of who your audience is and spend money there.
Yep.
Be aware of the celebrities. Did you guys give shoes to celebrities?
That's a great story too. I was on an airplane coming back from Minnesota, and the girl next to me was reading like People magazine and Us magazine, and that's when I was trying to figure out how do you get into that casual comfort Hollywood thing. And so my friend Doug, who I started the business with, you know, we always stayed friends. He's the one that said, "Well, why don't you try the stylists in Hollywood?" I'd never heard of them. But it's like the makeup artists and the hairstylists and the wardrobe people, they're working with the stars all the time. And so they're the ones that I found a mailing list, about 400 stylists, and I sent a letter and said, hey, if you want a free pair of UGG boots, give me a call. And about 45 of them did. And I just sent boots for nothing. And within 6 months, you know, we're watching TV and there's UGG boots showing up on a sitcom. You know, and then they started coming out in the movies, and then suddenly, you know, so-and-so is walking along the streets of Hollywood and gets snapped by a paparazzi, and before you know it, Uggs are all over People magazine. And I'm not saying it was quick. It took two or three seasons, but it's again, you can't give birth to adults. It was when I launched that celebrity thing, it went through its infancy, the birth conception infancy. And it wasn't until two or three years that it started toddling, and man, it just became a teenager overnight. So
yeah, it was huge, huge.
Yeah, that's what really got us into Oprah, and the rest was history once we got to her.
Well, congratulations on the success. The book, and I'm also going to give out the website, but the book is The Birth of a Brand. It's a fun read, full of great stories. You've heard some of them here today. There it is right up on your screen. And your website, for anyone who wants to check it out, is briansmithspeaker.com.
That's correct.
All right. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
Andrew, it was a pleasure. Hope your listeners really pick something up from it.
I do too, and I hope they get to see you speak somewhere in person.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you all for being a part of Mixergy. Bye, everyone.